Welcome to your Route to Wellbeing podcast. I'm Sue Fullergood, and I'm absolutely sure that you deserve to feel great, and it's possible for you to pulse with energy. So if you're not thriving right now, or if there's something that's interrupting your thriving, then maybe this podcast is just what you're looking for. I've tapped into the knowledge base of experts in the 11 domains of well-being. Each of the experts has something that I think is part of the crucial knowledge that you need to be able to really, really take care of yourself. And so listen in and see if you can get that magical piece of information that's going to make the difference for you. Please feel free to share this with your friends and family, whoever you think may benefit from it. Please push the subscribe button so that you can be alerted when future episodes are available. Thank you for listening. Hi, I'm Sue Fullergood, and this is your Route to Wellbeing podcast. And I am so excited this afternoon to have with me Maria Shiko, who is a spiritual business and life mentor for entrepreneurs and leaders. She is a former university professor who studied behavior change. So we really want to download some of the expertise that Maria has in her knowledge base. She is also a best-selling author, an award-winning educator, and has published in excess of 50 publications. Now, as a wannabe academic myself, I can tell you that's a huge number of publications to have brought to publication. So that's amazing. She's also been on television and on the radio in countless places. She's just a really important person for us to speak to. And thank you, Maria, for making time. And I really love the fact that her big goal in her work is to help her clients find their highest potential. And that's what I really wanted for you as the listeners today, to really see how you can find your way to really expressing your highest potential in the world. And I'm sure that some of what Maria is going to share with us today is going to help you in that direction. So without further ado, welcome, Maria, and thank you for being here. And can I invite you to just share with us a little bit about how you got to be doing the work that you're doing today?
Sure. Thank you, Sue. It's my pleasure to be on your show and podcast, and I'm excited to be here. I think a lot of the purpose and a lot of what I am sharing lately with my clients is that our highest potential and our purpose often is connected to knowing ourselves very, very deeply and finding our unique path and way in the world. And so for me, the journey of where I am today and what I'm doing and how I'm serving my clients comes from about a decade journey of learning about myself and trying to find myself and extracting myself maybe from some expectations or obligations that I have learned as a child, as a woman growing up, and then finding and grappling with some hard questions about life, finding things that actually feel joyful for me and feel uplifting and energy giving to me. And that required of me moving kind of my identity from my head to actually ability to feel, ability to be very strongly connected to my body, and some trauma work that also had to happen in the process, because our body often is conditioned by the experiences we've had as a human being on this planet. And sometimes this also involved trauma, and that was the case for me. So it's been a nonlinear process of the journey from the head to my heart and body. Let's put it this way.
I love the way you put that. And I understand that so well. It's so easy to spend your life in your head. And what a
a lemon of a life that would be. So if you can share with us how we can get from our heads to our hearts, that will be an amazing gift to give us. So thank you. Maria, I'd love you to tell us a little bit about self-leadership and how, well, first of all, why self-leadership? And second of all, how do we begin to cultivate it for ourselves? So maybe you can answer that question in two parts.
Sure. The way I define self-leadership, it's learning to trust ourselves. I think there is a general pandemic in at least the culture in which I came from, or this is what I often see with women especially and clients in general, is that I think it begins in the childhood where we are taught not to trust ourselves. And by trusting ourselves, I mean trusting our emotions that come up, acknowledging them, not necessarily getting lost in them, but embracing the humanness and the holistic aspect of our human existence and becoming a self-leader and learning to trust ourselves, I think has to do with a big portion of self-reparenting and changing the way we have been parented and learning maybe ways in which we can relate to ourselves from a more self-respected and self-respectful stance. And there is lots of literature on respectful parenting or compassionate parenting, which can be applied to, of course, children, if we do have children, but also the child within ourselves. And some of the foundational principles of this self-reparenting, they have to do with being present and not reacting, and being present with ourselves, not reacting to ourselves, allowing for emotions, allowing for desires, allowing for creative thinking, allowing for kind of inspiration to come into our lives, ideas, acknowledging the ideas that we do have and honoring them. And then that can be, of course, a negotiation, or part of it is logical, part of it is an intuitive process of figuring out which ideas can be applied to life and which are not maybe the most useful thing to pursue. But I find that through the process of reparenting, what we learn to realize is that we are so rich, we're so talented, we are given so many gifts from birth. And if we allow ourselves to cultivate this personal interest, and instead of judging them or negating them or minimizing them, we find wholeness. And this has been my personal process of personal transformation. We find wholeness within ourselves and then become the best part of ourselves.
I love that. You know, I always say, if we could just delight in the child within us in the way that the child we were deserved to be delighted in. I'm right onto this way that you describe reparenting. Yeah, thank you for that. And I see that self-compassion is really an important component of your work, and surely is a big component of mine too. So can you talk a little bit about how to bring the self-compassion into the leadership, self-leadership, but also into the reparenting?
So it's a great question, because I just was literally writing about this morning. And self-compassion to me means that when we struggle, and it's part of the reparenting, instead of being harsh and critical towards ourselves, we allow for the process to unfold. And compassion also has an element of patience and presence and non-reactivity to it. And self-compassion also, in this process of self-reparenting, what I have seen and experienced in myself and with the clients that I work, is that it requires changing the mindset and the approach of how we react to mistakes, how we react to frustration, to anger, to fear, and the intimacy, the more we're able to be intimate with ourselves and vulnerable with ourselves, because creative process and leadership process and pursuing your dreams in the world is a very vulnerable process. It almost requires us to be so vulnerable and quiet and present and fully open for those dreams to come through. And if we're harsh and judgmental, there is just too much fear to perform. And really, true heart desires cannot come in a place of self-judgment. It needs to be a much softer and gentler place to really, really be able to connect to our heart and listen to our heart for those desires to be expressed.
Mm. Mm. You grew up and were born in Russia.
Yes.
Obviously I have a stereotypical idea of Russia because I've never actually been there. I've been to many Eastern Bloc countries, but never to Russia itself. Can you share with us a little bit about how that's affected your life journey and also your work? And then maybe just add a piece at the end, if you would be so kind, as to what it's been like since you went to the United States.
Mm. It has shaped me a lot. And I would say that a lot of this self-reparenting and unconditioning, that's another term I often use, the unconditioning and reparenting, it comes from a lot of the cultural conditioning that has transpired from, you know, the time I was in my mom's belly until about 21, 22 years old. And I would say the culture, at least the way it used to be, it's very strongly connected to performance. You, in some ways, need to be perfect. There are some gender, not some, there are huge gender expectations about how a woman needs to be, how a man needs to be, how interactions and human interactions need to happen. And I would say it's a, in some ways, it's a society that is, on the one hand, people are extremely welcoming and hospitable, but I think internally they have very little self-value, self-worth, and self-confidence, and it shows up as externalized judgment, like judging, oh, did you wear the right dress? Did you look the right way? Did you say the right thing? Did you perform the right thing? So it's like a lot of it is externally focused, almost as of avoiding external judgment rather than really focusing on leading yourself and expressing yourself and choosing the life you want and desire for yourself. So I find that that has been my conditioning. And I would not say that the US is different in some ways on forms. It's shaped by different histories. I think religion has played a big role in the US compared to Russia. It has not played that role, but it also brought, you know, so there is shame and a lot of other feelings that are connected to slightly different historical periods and historical conditionings, but still the behaviors might manifest in a somewhat similar way.
Gosh, that's interesting. We would like to think, because that's what the media has convinced us, that Russia and America are on two opposite sides of the same, of a spectrum. And it's interesting to hear that there's not that much difference in the outcome, even though the input was different. Yeah. Wow. Thank you for telling us about that. And so if we come back to this very important subject of self-leadership, how does that affect your life if you're going to focus on being a self-leader? What can you hope to, dare I say, achieve out of that? What would be your answer to what's the outcome or the benefit, if you want?
So I think my life has shifted in a gazillion ways. And I also see the clients who follow that path, their lives might be very different than maybe someone who is not asking the questions of what do I want from life and how do I think, and let me examine my thoughts, let me examine the choices that I make on a daily basis. And so self-leadership to me requires a very curious mindset and also this desire for truth, even when truth is deeply painful and uncomfortable. And self-leadership requires for a level of courage to maybe make choices that are not necessarily aligned with culture or family. And the choices might be very practical choices. Entrepreneurship, it can be a seemingly benign choice, but if it's not something that is, if it's considered by your family or culture as very risky, the question becomes, do you align with the cautiousness, or do you align with what you actually truly want for yourself? This is one example. The way you decide to parent your children, again, there are expectations that requires huge self-leadership because there are habits, and that connects to our behavior change and our kind of bringing new practices into the start of a child's life. The new way in which you parent a child requires leadership when you have to set boundaries, when you have to educate your own family members about you parenting your child in a different way, and maybe having uncomfortable conversations. Because in my experience, even positive changes often are resisted simply because they represent change. So it doesn't have to be a drastic change. It can be not wearing a specific clothes or wearing a specific clothes. It can create a lot of reaction and resistance from people, or choosing a professional path when you are expected to be a stay-at-home mother, or, you know, like it in my experience, or even the way you take care of your body or not take care of your body, what you eat, it's really impacts every single aspect of our lives. And I think what happens in terms of how we make those choices, how we communicate those choices, do we decide to consistently stick with those choices in a very disciplined way, even when there is resistance? The self-leadership really can translate into every single aspect of one's life.
It's a hard path in many ways, possibly fulfilling and yet hard. My question to you is there a way to titrate it, to start small and grow as your strength and resilience and courage grow?
Absolutely. I think the first way, to make it easier, make the change and don't tell anyone. Because you don't need approval of others to make a change. Just do it in the quiet. And then when you see things are working for you, then you can begin to share. Because you don't need to invite outside critics into your life when you are still kind of learning how to walk or learning to find your footing in the path that you're choosing. So I would say that the first thing is that you do not need to seek approval, and you can make a small change, and then as it grows, then begin to share. I think the other aspect of this change to make it easy is to find like-minded people. Find people, find community, find podcasts, find meetup groups, find friends, find someone online who has done it or who is thinking in the same way, who has similar challenges, and you can actually feel safe with that person to share. Because I think the power of encouragement, especially we are social beings and we need it, it kind of goes into our fear of survival and being ostracized from society if we choose a different path. So finding someone who is an ally in some of the changes that you desire to make is so, so important. Another aspect is read books, listen to podcasts, get educated, because I think this education gap and education and information access is so essential. Sometimes we feel things intuitively, but we cannot explain. You're like, I've had clients who are like, okay, I just have to be here. I don't know why. I don't understand why I was pulled to do this, or I had to be here. But I think the more we get access to education, then our brain can catch up, and then we can, from that place, we can feel more empowered and more confident and more really stepping into our leadership when we have access to information. And I think this is the value of the podcast that you're creating by actually educating people and sharing information with others, is that when people are informed, they have the power. And I think the final step is celebrate small victories. Just celebrate, because it's a long journey. It's a lifelong journey. And seeing your own progress and celebrating yourself every single step of the way needs to happen to keep the motivation going.
I think that women have actually stepped bravely, maybe more bravely than men, into the space of self-leadership. And I think it's possible that we need to encourage the men and the boys in our midst to step into that arena as well, even if it's uncomfortable. Do you think it's more, more of women are more prone towards it, attracted towards it, if you like?
You're the first person I'm hearing this from, and yet it makes sense in some ways. I think women are more comfortable with emotions and being with the uncomfortable, because I feel we're uncomfortable a lot of the times in our life, even giving birth or resolving conflict. Usually women are the ones who do that more naturally than maybe men, traditional stereotypes of men. And I think to encourage boys or to encourage men, I think it needs to happen, since more women are stepping into their leadership. One, it needs to happen from the way we parent our children. And that is power in women's hands to do that. If we parent our children and we do not reinforce those stereotypes, I think it creates a very different child, including a boy. And since women are educators, most women, they work as teachers or caretakers, or they are teachers in schools. So I think the more we're able to bring this self-leadership notion and concept into educational systems from birth up until teenage and university, higher ed, and that is in the hands of women. So another question I have is, do really women want empowered men? because women also would need to take responsibility for some of their patterns as well.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to say more about that? Because that's a really interesting question.
Well, the empowered men, I think, would not want women criticizing men all the time. If, for example, the old dynamic that I have seen in my culture, or I have seen even in the US culture and other cultures, because I've worked with clients from different cultures, is that there is a general stereotype of women not being satisfied, criticizing, nagging, being unhappy, kind of falling a little bit into the victim mindset of, oh, I'm a victim of this relationship, or I'm a victim of this, he's doing this to me, or he's this or that. And I'm not saying this is not true, but at the same time, what I'm saying often is that an empowered man would want a very different woman next to him, a woman who would respect him, and that it has a partnership. It doesn't have a hierarchy, but more of a partnership, a partners who co-create, partners who encourage each other's dreams, partners who encourage each other's creativity and goals and help each other pursue it. And so if we expect men to be breadwinners and bring, you know, money home and provide for us, then they kind of must do that. And they have to do and ignore kind of their dreams and pursuits in many ways. But then that requires a different distribution, maybe of roles in the family as well.
I think the key critical thing in this is freeing yourself of the need for approval. And I know when my children were little, I used to say, it doesn't matter whether I like what you're doing or not. It's got nothing to do with it. Do you like it?
Yes.
And that was so different from how I was raised, you know, whereas everything was about pleasing my mother, specifically, yes. Her lovely heart. But, you know, if she wasn't pleased, it was a crisis. And so, you know, we didn't dare. And I think if we can raise children to be non-approval seeking, that we'll liberate them to be the best versions of themselves. And as you rightly say, if we don't need approval and we don't need to fit into the patterns, then we have the capacity to create a whole new life for ourselves, a whole new way of being for ourselves. And that partnership is part of that new way of being. And can you share a little bit about how you discovered this path? What brought you to this understanding? You have shared about being raised in Russia, but how did you come to this knowledge? It's not just knowledge. I think there's something that's in your cells.
So I wish I could say that I just woke up one morning and I discovered it, but I find it has been a journey. So if I were to be more specific, I followed very much a traditional path until I was about 30. And it was instilled in me that I need to be a wife. I need to, not only I need to be a wife, but I need to put a man first. And I was extremely smart. I was extremely curious, talented in many ways. And, you know, in my first marriage, my mom would give me an advice. For example, if I were to write an article with my ex-husband, she would tell me the thing is, he needs to be the first author. I'm like, that is an interesting perspective. Like, why would he be a first author? And she would say, well, because he's a man. And it created such a strong feeling of anger and rage in me that the feeling of disagreeing that somebody needs to be something because of their skin color or because of their gender or because of, you know, any other thing that they have or don't have. And so that created a lot of rebellion in me. And what I have also seen, I was just very unhappy in the path that I have pursued because I was trying to be a good girl. I was raised to be a good girl, please my parents and kind of please the teacher, get the good grades, do all the right things. But what have transpired in my personal life is that while pursuing those things, I have noticed that there was a discrepancy between kind of the accumulated things that I externally had, marriage, degrees, job, you know, kind of the social status. I have accumulated those things, but inside I felt completely empty and not aligned and not authentic to myself. And I also developed a very strong depression, hopelessness, not understanding why I'm here, what am I doing here? What's the point of actually living a life like this? And so it started from a very dark place of asking those questions and noticing that on the outside, there was one person, but inside of me, what I was feeling was completely misaligned. And I started searching. I became searching. I started practicing yoga, meditating, asking questions, reading books, trying different things, experimenting, making choices that felt very, very uncomfortable for me at the time, that felt they would elicit great disapproval, and which they did. They did elicit great disapproval from some of the family members or family or people that knew me, but I had to start choosing myself versus others at some point. And little by little by little, I started searching, talking to people, reading, educating myself, and making trust in my gut, trusting what I feel versus what I think, kind of drawing a line and some differences between the conditioned mind and what is actually my body telling me. And so little by little, step by step, in retrospect, it was a million steps that now I can articulate so eloquently on your podcast. But if you saw me in the process of it, I was a complete mess.
I understand. And it's almost the hero's journey, isn't it? You had to lose everything in order to find everything. And it is a really hard journey, you know, a real hero's journey to take. And at what point in that journey did you leave America? Leave Russia and come to America?
I moved to the US when I was 21. Mm-hmm. So right after I graduated with my master's in Russia.
Sure. You graduated with a master's at 21.
Yep. It's a fast track in Russia. They don't let you be a child.
Sure.
It's a fast track.
My goodness. And saying that, I mean, just in terms of your reparenting, have you been able, in among all the searching and, have you been able to allow yourself to be a child in your adult life?
Yes.
You can play now?
I can play now. I've spent a few years doing that. I dance. I love dancing, painting, being in nature, swimming, going naked into the woods. Now I also have a son, so I play with him. We play ball and balloons and all kinds of things. But I had to take a few years because I also faced a burnout at work. I was used to be a university professor, so I, especially since I left academia, while being in academia as well, I traveled extensively. So I traveled the world extensively, backpacked, ate lots of ice cream.
Yeah. So, I mean, is it okay for you to share a little bit about the burnout for us? Because I think that is something that is so rife, certainly in my listenership right now. I find every second person is walking into my consulting room and just going, I am so tired. I just wake up tired. I go to bed tired. Yeah. I don't know if it's full blown burnout in every one of them, but can you share a little bit about your journey?
Yes. I remember actually when I got my tenure at the university, the way that burnout showed up. And at that point, I already was letting myself dance. And I cannot say that I was still attending to my needs at that point. But I remember that when I got my tenure and I went on a sabbatical, the first 6 months of that sabbatical, that which was a year, I laid in a hammock for 6 months and I did nothing. I did not clean my house. I did not cook for myself. I did not do anything productive. I did not read any books. I just literally laid in a hammock and I think I survived on sandwiches and just eating fruit, anything that did not require for me to do anything really. And after doing this for 6 months, I was laying down and talking to trees. And there was like two pine trees in my neighbor's yard and I was talking to them. Sometimes I just even prohibited myself to think. I'm like, you're not allowed to think. You just be here now. That's all. And it was challenging. It was very challenging because I think only afterwards I was able to find this inner light or inner fire and inner motivation to like, oh, that would be nice to do this, or it would be nice to do that. So it was not coming from the place of like, I have to clean my house, or I have to cook for myself, or I have to go and talk to this person. but it came more from the inside rather than an external pressure of performing and doing and achieving. And I was raised in a culture that values achievement a lot, and I have played that game a lot. But it, and another aspect, another symptom of the burnout I had, I literally like could not see. I could not turn on the computer, because every time now we're talking over the computer screen, but in the past, if I would turn the computer, my eyes would start twitching, going red. I would start tearing and crying. So my eyes could not even look at the screen.
Wow, so, that would be scary for you.
Yes. So it really showed me, my body was telling me, you cannot keep going like this. Yes.
And thank God, eventually you listened.
Yeah.
Were you on your own? Were you single at this time? Because I was, quite difficult to just sit in a hammock, lie in a hammock when you're married or have children.
Yep. Yeah. Yes. At that moment, I was single. But even now, because I have been in a burnout and I know what it takes, I know that it takes months. Now, when I have the tendency to work and I notice like my mind is not as sharp, or I notice that maybe I don't have as much energy, I'm not motivated, what I do, I just close my job for a week. I basically do nothing for a week. I don't turn on my computer. I don't turn my phone on. And I do have a 3.5-year-old now. So I either negotiate with my partner, or we do just basics. We just do basics. Take out food. We do basics until my body actually restores. And then I know when I'm restored, because then I actually have inspiration that comes from inside to do something. It's not coming from the pressure, external pressure.
So can you talk a little bit for the listeners about how do you know the difference between a desire that's coming from the inside and a should that's coming from the outside? How do you hear the difference, if you like?
For me, it's very viscerally connected to my body and the thoughts I experience in the moment. So if I clean the house and I feel resentful cleaning the house and putting things away and organizing, I'm like, oh, I have to do this. I hate everyone. My husband should have put this to his place. And my son, I'm like, stop it. You do not have to do anything. And I don't. And I actually don't. So if I am doing anything, or if I write my newsletter and I'm like, oh, nobody reads this newsletter, nobody needs to hear this, I've said it 100 times. I'm like, stop it. Don't do it. Then don't send a newsletter. I don't want to create from this energy. I don't want to create from this way of thinking or doing things. And then I remind myself that I actually don't have to do anything at all. The world will not
end. You're not in an orange outfit. You don't have to do anything.
Yeah. So, and I think it's also part a little bit of this undoing the female conditioning, because I felt like my mom has always been in this victim mentality, and I've seen it often. And so I had to like, no, like, you don't want to do it, just don't do it. And then I asked myself, often I meditate or I go in nature and rest. And then I noticed that I actually feel better when the house is clean. And I feel that I truly desire to share with people, because I want to inspire change, and I want to inspire, make it easier for others on their journeys. And then I might do exactly the same thing. It might still involve cleaning or writing a newsletter, but the energy behind this becomes very different. The thoughts and the feelings in the body are very different. They come from a different place. And the process changes.
Yes. Yeah. It's amazing how important it is to learn to listen to that body voice. And people think that sounds so complicated and difficult, but the body talks, okay, with a soft voice, which the mind can easily drown out, but it does talk in sensations that are pretty clear if we learn to speak that language and tune into that radio station.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you. And I know that you've written books. Can you tell us a little bit about the books that you have written and how writing these books has helped you with your develop, if you like, your concept of self-leadership?
So I have a memoir that is the first book that I have written. Then the second book I've written is with a friend and a colleague of mine. It's the money book, my brilliant money book for joyful and creative living. And the third book, it's a collaboration with other authors, and it's the stories of pain and how to overcome pain and find joys and joy in leadership. So I would say that I never imagined that I would write a book if I were to start a few years back. And it just came up for me in a sense that there was this very strong desire and almost a knowing in my body that I have to share my story in some way. And this is how the memoir came about. I sat down, I wrote it. I've never written a book before. And writing this memoir was so different from academic writing, because in the academic writing, the personal voice and the subjective voice, at least the way I have been trained, does not exist. So it's all about data and statistics and p-values and statistical significance and all of that. So I feel it's been a huge learning curve for me to even begin to find my personal voice through putting the statement I on the page and in actually sharing some of the feelings and the experiences that have transpired, because that probably hugely impacted me from being in my head to actually come into my body and owning my story more and more. Mm-hmm. And it brought up very hard feelings, lots of grief, lots of shame. I was extremely scared of sharing that story with the world. And I burned my diaries. I deleted the files from my computer. And I'm like, no, I'm not doing this. I'm done. And then a month later, I just couldn't sleep. I just couldn't think of something else. And it just felt like this book had to happen. And so then I sat again and I wrote it again.
Wow.
And then I found an editor who helped me make it more understandable and kind of put the reader's perspective and the reader's eyes on the pages so that others can understand the story more coherently. Mm-hmm. And then I self-published. That was the first book. And the second book was about money, and that it has been a huge part of my story as well, because the question that I was grappling with while writing that book had to do with how can money be joyful? How can I not sacrifice myself for money, for making money? Because that's how it frequently felt in the past, that I have to sacrifice myself in order to get paid. And I said that it was time to break that cycle. So that's how that was really the question, the big question behind that book.
Mm-hmm. And the third book?
And the third book came about serendipitously, because I'm in the process of applying for giving a TEDx talk. And through the process, I've met some other fellow journey takers, let's put it this way. And we came together, and Elena Fernandez, who edited the book, she brought us all together and asked us to share stories that represented a transformation from pain to some kind of outcome that really had a huge impact on our lives. So for me, it was from suicide to self-leadership, for example. So that is the story that I have shared in that book.
Wow. And you didn't share the names of your books. If people want to read them,
yes.
What are the names?
So the first book is called From Russia to Joy, A Journey of Spiritual Awakening. The second book is called My Brilliant Money Book for Joyful and Creative Living. And the last book is called The Stories of Pain.
They're all available on Amazon. I shall definitely get my order in soon. I'm sorry that I haven't read them yet, but I look forward to that. You bring a lot of intuition development into your work. Can you talk a little bit more about developing your intuition and how you help your clients to do that? Maybe to start by defining intuition as you see it.
So intuition is one of these things that we cannot see, similarly to creativity and inspiration. And the way I define intuition, it's an unborn wisdom that we all come with at birth. And if we're given a chance to listen to it, then we can be wise and we can be in many ways confident. And the practical use of intuition is to make choices in every single day, in every life. Intuition is connected strongly to our body experiences, although it can be tainted by trauma. Intuition is also connected to a deeper knowing and wisdom around some maybe bigger choices that we make about our life. And it also is connected to our soul's journey in this lifetime, on this earth. So it's connected to the hero's journey, what we're here to learn, the lessons we're learning here, some maybe biggest encounters in our life that we do experience, and kind of the purpose of why we are here, what we're here to do.
Absolutely. And how do you help people to develop that? How can the listeners work with themselves to develop their intuition a little better?
Mm-hmm.
Or listen to their intuition, which is already there.
So I would say, if I were to give a very, very simple step-by-step process, even though it's never always simple, but I would say one is self-compassion is the first step, because sometimes intuition might come as a very strong emotion, anger, resentment, rage, fear, anxiety. And so developing self-compassion is the first step, and being able to listen, observe, and acknowledge some of the internal processes that do happen within our mind or body. Sometimes they come as feelings or emotions. Another aspect of developing intuition is actually doing something creative, because it engages the a different hemisphere of our brain. So logic is usually left hemisphere, and intuition, creativity, self-expression is connected more to the right hemisphere of the brain. So movement, dance, yoga, painting, intuitive painting, dance, I don't know if I've mentioned that, poetry, creating poetry, and actually allowing ourselves creative writing. So anything that has to do with creative expression and doing things with your hand and body, they help to develop intuition. Mm-hmm. And because what happens often when we go into the right hemisphere of our brain, we access deeper knowing that often is beyond the logic. Another aspect that helps with intuition is creating practices that cultivate safety in your life, safety in your body. So it can be taking a bath, doing any kind of healing work, Reiki, meditation, prayer, women's circles, walking in nature, singing, karaoke, anything that relaxes your body, and anything that creates this feeling that I am safe, because often we function in a fight or flight response, and anything that helps to help you feel safe, it brings out this child inside, because the intuition is strongly connected to the inner child, and children often know so much more because they're not conditioned to think and override their biological instincts. And so it's accessing this inner child that helps us bring to light and really unleash and free up the intuition that's inside of us.
Oh, you're really speaking my language here. I love this about feeling safety. How do people know when they're feeling safe? Because, you know, it's just not something we normally tuned into, you know. We don't realize how unsafe maybe that we are feeling, even if we're aware that we've been through trauma, little t trauma or big T trauma. We don't really realize that we're sitting and living in fight and flight. So how do people know when they're relaxed and safe?
Well, I would describe it. Imagine you're having a good conversation with a friend and you're laughing and you can be yourself. You're not worried about what they think about you and they just accept you as you are. And this is the feeling of safety. To me, this is just one example of a feeling of safety where you can be yourself, you're not censoring yourself, and you feel safe. But then I would say reactions, sometimes noticing our reactivity and our reaction to things is then when we can see that this is a sign of trauma or a sign that we're not feeling safe. So a sign of reaction or examples of reactions might be the way we talk to our children. Like, oh, put this back, wash your hands. You have to do this now. You have to do this now. These are all reactions because we maybe aspire for, if we were not in reaction, if we were safe, we would actually say, oh, I really care about you. I want you to be safe in this world. I want you to be accepted in this world. And because I care so much, I'm controlling your behavior. I'm telling you what to do. So another aspect of safety I find is vulnerability and being vulnerable with ourselves and actually naming honestly, transparently, and vulnerably what we're actually feeling in the present moment. Or, oh, I feel a little bit insecure right now, and therefore I'm going to please you right now, even though it's not feeling good. And this is the pattern I'm running by trying to please you, even though by pleasing you, I'm actually abandoning myself and I'm abandoning what I actually desire for myself and what I really want to say. I just want to be friends with you. I don't want to be pleasing you. I just want to be friends with you right now. That's all. So I find that safety in relationships, safety in parenting, safety in a job often comes when we start cultivating safety within ourselves, and then we can take it and extrapolate it to other situations in our lives.
I love that you have highlighted that when you are feeling safe, you can, I would like to say, have 50% of the attention inside and 50% of the attention outside, so that you're in connected to yourself while connecting to somebody else, not letting go of yourself so that you're worried about the outside only and therefore not being authentic. And I think the problem with so much of this unsafety is that people are not aware. It's such an unconscious thing, and that the defense mechanisms that we've developed to deal with our unsafety are so unconscious that it's really helpful to bring consciousness to this and to be able to see, gosh, I'm not feeling safe, and therefore I am doing my people-pleasing defense mechanism or whatever it is. And meet that with compassion and truth. Yeah.
Yes.
Wow. You have a very beautiful way of putting things so succinctly. Thank you for really the clarity with which you explain things. It does really, really help. And if you were to give one message to our listeners that you think could make their lives better, what would that one Maria message be?
That's a tough one, but let's let me share the quote that really has impacted my life a lot. And it goes like this: trust your joy, everything is possible. And this is a quote that I have been given by my spiritual teacher a number of years ago. She has passed since. And what I think the way that I am understanding is that joy is viscerally connected to how we feel. And joy is not always, especially for people who are grown up and mature, maybe don't jump around as much. And, you know, they express joy more quietly rather than the way children express joy. But this joy has a level of very, very deep satisfaction with the present moment. And usually when you trust your joy, it's, to me, it's like a marker or a pointer or a compass, internal compass of the intuition. If you trust this, something that feels good, can you grow it and water it and make it into a big tree into your life? And you can start small and then let this tree grow bigger and bigger and expand into all areas.
I mean, we so seldom even think about joy, never mind use it as our compass. So that is a really profound thing. Trust your joy. Sure. And I think that starts with tune into your joy, be able to recognize when you're feeling joy.
Yes.
And then step number two is to trust it. Yeah.
Yes.
Wow, we have learned so much from you, Maria, and it has been such a treat to spend this hour with you. I wish we could talk some more. In fact, I'm definitely going to book another podcast with you because I honestly think that you have so much to teach us about self-leadership. And I, as I said, I love the way you make things so easy to understand. Thank you for your time. Thank you for your wisdom. Thank you for trusting yourself and leading yourself, so that we as the rest of the world could enjoy the creativity you have brought to the planet. If people want to work with you, how do they get in touch with you?
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed this conversation a lot, and thank you. So the way they can find me, I am active on Instagram and Facebook. I also have my website. It's my first and last name. So by all my social media accounts, they are Maria Shriko, with the way I spell it, with Y's. And my website is mariashriko.love, L-O-V-E. And I have courses if people interested are working in groups. I have one-on-one services. If people are interested in more individualized attentions, I have healing offerings. So it's a spectrum of things that I help people to use, and they draw from different disciplines to help them step more and more into their power and honor themselves and honor their dreams as well.
Well, I look forward to the next time we get to speak, and I hope you have a beautiful evening further. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.